This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Thomas Jefferson wrote the words that have guided America since its creation and reflect us at our best. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Yet, Jefferson was a slaveholder. That's just one of the contradictions Ken Burns explores in his new documentary on Jefferson, which will be shown on PBS stations February 18th and 19th. Burns describes it as the prequel to his Civil War series, which was the highest-rated series in PBS history. Burns also made the PBS series on baseball. Before we get to some of the contradictions in Jefferson's character, let's just sum up why he's so important.
He is the author of our country. He wrote our creed. That one sentence, the second sentence of the Declaration, is our creed. It's what we all agree as Americans is true, you know, inalienable, that this is moot. We're not going to talk about this anymore. This is what we have. He is, therefore, the author of our essential freedoms. He is the author of our political freedoms, obviously issuing from that great Declaration and other remarkable writing. He is the codifier, one of the authors, of our religious freedom, something that some scholars think is even more important and significant than the political achievement. He said, for the first time in human history, something that went against the grain of every tendency of human beings. He said, we will separate the processes of our political and social lives from the dictates of our religion. And that has made all the difference for us. He is the author of our intellectual freedoms. He founded the first university in the history of the world not connected with a church or its dogma. That has set in motion our modern life. And he could have followed John Locke and said life, liberty, and property. It'd been perfectly reasonable thing to do. Instead, he said life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And we have been wondering what he meant ever since. You know, what's happiness? Is it meaning that you're going to be in a good mood? Is it the acquisition of material things? What is happiness? And I think what he did more than anything else is he said that Americans and America wasn't an end in and of itself, but something that was constantly questing. It wasn't happiness. And by happiness, he didn't mean the hedonistic pursuit of things at the mall. He meant the improvement of the mind and the heart, a kind of spiritual growth that would be possible once life and liberty were done. It was the marketplace of ideas.
And what he wanted to guarantee was its pursuit, not its accomplishment.
Absolutely right, that it isn't happiness. You never get it. Perfection's impossible. It's the pursuit of us. And that, I think, for Americans has made all the difference.
Let's get to the idea that Thomas Jefferson writes, all men are created equal, and then holds, what, 200 slaves?
At its height, more than 200 human beings.
What were you able to find out about the kind of slaveholder he was?
Well, I think he was a fairly, this is so hard to say, he was a fairly enlightened slave owner. He considered his slaves part of his family. He had a kind of patronizing, in a good way, attitude towards this family. But at the same time, he owned them. You know, one of his nephews murdered one of his slaves because they dropped a teacup and broke a teacup that had belonged to their mother. And the important thing that we forget is that slavery isn't an abstract thing that we debate, that these are real lives lived, being denied the chance to learn a written language, being denied the chance to keep a family together. They changed the wedding vows till death or distance do we part.
Really?
Yeah, because it might be economically advantageous to break up a family.
Now, he wrote a little bit about slaves and about Africans who were brought to America. And he described them as being intellectually inferior, as smelling really badly because of the makeup of their bodies, not because they weren't allowed to bathe.
This is scientific racism.
Right.
And he wrote one book in his life, Notes on the State of Virginia, which is a rambling, wonderful book. But in it, he has these statements that stab you, wound you to the heart about the inferiority of blacks. There's lots of questioning, too. He thinks that he may be condemning a whole race prematurely. He doesn't know. You see it as this restless, tormenting question for him all the time.
Could you just say, well, everybody of Jefferson's stature had slaves, so it would be expecting too much for even Jefferson to be different. Would that be?
I want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you want to say, You know, one of the things I hate as an amateur historian is the arrogance of the present to assume that it can go back to the past and pronounce some judgments, you know. And one of the great people who rush very sincerely to his defense say, oh, he's a man of his time.
Right.
You know, but I don't think you can do that. His neighbor, Edward Coles, freed his slaves and really urged vociferously for Jefferson to do the same. Jefferson didn't respond. His mentor, George Washington, eventually freed his slaves. His cousin, John Randolph, freed his slaves. The free black population of Virginia is growing all the time. And Jefferson's not doing something. And a lot of this, to be fair to him, is tied up with his debts. He inherits a lot of his slaves and land from his father-in-law when he dies. And he also inherits a lot of debt. And he's constantly scrambling all his adult life, not very conscientiously, but scrambling nonetheless to sort of free himself of this debt. And I think he feels in some ways imprisoned that he can't let go. You know, he once said about slavery, it was like holding a wolf by the ears. You didn't like it, but you didn't dare let go. It's a great image, and I think it's less a political description than it is his own personal anguish. At the same time, you can't let the man who writes the most important statement about human freedom completely off the hook. We celebrate him today, as our consultant Paul Finkelman said. We don't build a memorial, and we don't put somebody on the nickel who's just a man of his time. I think in some ways the most difficult thing for me was to confront, to really hold his feet to the fire, to listen to John Hope Franklin with the knowledge that he was speaking the truth, but a great deal of pain when he said, the legacy of Jefferson is both a blessing and a curse.
He is said to have had a sexual relationship with one of his slaves, Sally Hemings, and to be the father of her children. Your film is inconclusive about that. Some people say, oh, he definitely did. Others say it's really unlikely that he did.
I wanted to leave it that way, too. It's really important to me for a number of reasons. First of all, one of the historians said that if it really came to a trial right now, and when he says that, I hear OJ.
Right.
That he would probably be found not guilty. That is to say, there would not be enough conclusive evidence either way. You can't prove or disprove it, though there is poignant testimony of the descendants of Sally Hemings who believe that their great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather is the third president of the United States. And these are light-skinned African-Americans with reddish hair and freckles, looking very much like an offspring of Thomas Jefferson.
And who have had the story handed
and
down
who have
from
had
generation
this
to generation,
in what is
oral
probably
history.
The most credible thing is this oral history, lacking the conclusive proof. And there are historians of all stripe who vehemently say this is impossible, this is outside the character. To me, I think it enters into, and this was, remember, promoted as a scandal. A newspaper man that used to work for Jefferson, savaging the Federalists, got angry at Jefferson. He didn't give him enough political plums. He went over to the Federalists, and the first thing he did is savage Jefferson in the by-elections of 1802 with this scandal mongering. So it's very contemporary. The thing that I think the Sally Hemings story has fed into is our late 20th century tabloid sensibility, the kind of did he or didn't he. No matter who you are, college professor, angry student, you still, it comes down to did he or didn't he. And it has a kind of sexual titillation to it. I wanted to step back and say the most important thing here that we shouldn't lose sight of, despite the obvious power and domination that sex and all of that implies between a man and a female, and a particularly a master and a slave, is that he owned her, that he could have done anything with her. He could have killed her. And that we sometimes forget that. That's at the center of it. And as John Hope Franklin said, so he may or may not have fathered her children, but we can hold him responsible for all of those illicit, difficult, dark relationships that take place in the secrecy of this horrible institution which we tolerated for too long in this country, called chattel slavery.
My guest is Ken Burns, and his new film on Thomas Jefferson will be shown on public television February 18th and 19th. We'll take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Ken Burns, and his film Thomas Jefferson will be shown on public television February 18th and 19th. Well, we've been talking about the contradiction between saying all men are created equal and owning slaves, and that's hardly the only contradiction in his character. He was against a very strong federal government and then goes on to become our third president. What are some of the things he did as third president that maybe didn't quite jive with his philosophy?
Well, it's important to give him credit that having watched what he felt was the wrong interpretation of the Constitution by the Federalists, that is to say, a too strong central government, he really set about eliminating the Alien and Sedition Acts that had so troubled civil libertarians, including himself, and really gutted a lot of the federal government, let the Navy, unfortunately, sort of shrink down. But he did an amazing thing. You'll have to look at his presidency. The single most important accomplishment is that he purchased Louisiana from the French, thereby doubling the size of the country. It was a sum nearly twice the federal budget. It's the greatest land deal in history. It's the best decision that any president would have made in that case, but it ran counter to this love of small government, and he so ensured the continental nation that we'd become. I mean, manifest destiny becomes a practical consideration the moment we buy Louisiana.
As your film points out, it like doubles the amount of land.
It's an amazing
gets
thing.
The French basically out of what
well, what it
the
does
United
is
States.
It actually the French know that they're not really going to be able to hang on to things, so that by selling us Louisiana, they've put a kind of check in front of the British. And for us to buy Louisiana, we're happy to do that because we can provide a buffer to the British. We become a world power at that moment, a developing world power. But it's great geopolitics that Jefferson and Napoleon are playing. And Napoleon says, I have just given the world a rival to Britain.
You're interested not only in Jefferson's actions, but in his private life, too,
yeah.
And how his private life might have affected his public life. When he was writing the Declaration of Independence, what was happening in his personal life?
Well, he'd already lost a child in childbirth or early on. And his wife was there, sick, with the birth of another child who eventually died. He was constantly torn all his life between this sense of wishing to be on the political stage and retreating. Some of it was really false. I mean, he was a shrewd political operator and didn't hesitate to hire people like James Callender, who would savage the Federalists at every turn. But he's always desiring to go back into the lap and the love of his family and his farm. And he constantly not just threatens to retire, he does retire. He quits as Secretary of State. He basically goes home as Vice President. He's always being pulled back to a family life, which you can see by going to Monticello was a wonderfully sustaining thing. But when you read what happened in his own life, it just must have been, you know, he never came to terms with grief. He was constantly losing people. And he could never figure out in the midst of all of his great thoughts what to do with the loss that was afflicting him all the time.
And who was he losing while he was writing the Declaration?
He was losing a child. And eventually, not too long after the Revolution ended, his wife, Martha, called Patty, died in a very long sickness in which he stayed by her at the last moments. It's really an incredibly poignant scene. And when he dies, he just loses it. For 3 weeks, he's completely sleeps on the floor. He wails. He moans. He forges a connection with his daughter, Martha, who they call Patsy at that time. And fortunately for him, for us, Patsy survives him. It's the only child. Five of the six children die. And I can't, as a father myself, just even think about what that must have done.
Jefferson wanted to see separation of church and state in America. Really forceful advocate for that, obviously. What were his own religious views? What was his own religious life like?
It was, at first blush, fairly unstructured. He's sort of called a deist. And in fact, what made the election of 1800 so absolutely worse. I mean, when we complain today, it was nothing. Robbery, rape, murder, mayhem, one Federalist paper said, will occur openly. Our daughters will be sent into whorehouses if Thomas Jefferson is elected. They saw him as godless, as a complete atheist. But in fact, Jefferson, refers to the Creator in his one great sentence. He edited the Gospels of Jesus Christ, editing out what he thought was sort of the extravagance, the hyperbole, the stuff, and kept what he felt were the true words of Jesus. And today we still read and look through a pasted collection of the Gospels, which we call the Jefferson Bible, which apparently he turned to at times of comfort when he lost a daughter or a wife. And this is at the heart of him, I think, is a person who is not a religious, but so intensely personal in his relationship to his Creator, here at the boiling point of rationalism, you know, where he is just, he's looking for facts, you know. Are there Welsh Indians out there where Lewis and Clark can find them? Are there hills of pure salt? Are there volcanoes? Are there still woolly mammoths? You know, I want to know all the time. And I think we tend to dismiss a side that is, from his writings, betray an incredibly spiritual sensitivity.
So he's editing the Bible, huh?
He's editing the Bible, if you can believe it.
So what are some of the things he edited out?
Well, you know, it's funny. You can I don't have a specific example, but as you look at it, I mean, literally, it's a cut and paste job. And he's sitting there taking Matthew or Luke or John, and he's cutting out. So you might go from line, you know, chapter 2, line 39 to line 44. And what he's losing is what he thinks is apocryphal. He wants to hear the practical words of a great teacher. Is how I think it is, and this is no scholarship behind my interpretation. I just sort of feel that as I look at the Jefferson Bible, he's seeing Christ as a great teacher, a moral teacher, and he's hoping that we can inherit what is something essential in Christianity.
Thomas Jefferson lived in an era before photography.
Yeah.
So you're stuck making a film about Thomas Jefferson because there's no pictures.
And I don't want it to be the powdered wig, white quill pen, green felt table stuff that is the kind of broccoli and cauliflower of documentary films. I wanted the 18th century to come alive as much as you can make, say, the 19th century come alive because there's an abundant use of photographs.
So what'd you use?
I cheated and I used some photographs. I actually hired a cameraman who took an early primitive camera, the closest process I could find to Jefferson's time, back to Monticello and just document every square foot of Monticello so that it would be possible to zoom through one photograph, dissolve into another, and feel perhaps like you were moving through a space. And I think it's fairly successful. It's a kind of 18th or 19th century virtual reality that I think helps you ground yourself in the place. We are more dependent on live cinematography, which has always been a hallmark of the type of work we've done, that is to place yourself in front of the ghosts and echoes of this inexpressibly wise past and wait and see what happens, you know, at dawn, at sunset. So there's lots of that, covering Monticello, going to Paris, going to Philadelphia, you know, all around, trying to collect his life, the places that he'd been. And the paintings, to some extent, fill it out. I work with the independent filmmaker, cinematographer Peter Hutton, who does work so completely different than mine. But I've hired him on every film, and he went with his small little Bolex camera and took sort of jerry-rigged time-lapse of moments, very shaky black and white footages of light dappled on wallpaper or on walls or chairs. And what we were straining to do was to try to take back from Monticello more than the postcard view of it, and to hopefully intimate that there was once an interesting man who lived here with a family that was dying all around him, with grandchildren who he loved, with slaves who offered him sort of exquisite torture. That was important to come back with that stuff.
Have you ever thought, oh, this will be an interesting project, and you started it and you thought, this really actually isn't very interesting, and I'm not finding anything that I'm looking for here, and I think I will abandon it?
No, I'm very fortunate. I want to knock on wood. I have finished the projects that I've started. And I think in part because it finally doesn't matter what they were. I mean, of course it does. It's central to who it is. It's just like the people that we end up with as friends or even mates for life. It's not so much that it is them that we found the only one. It is that here that we have agreed to park and practice. In the case of friends and loved ones, how you get along with people, how you love, what's unconditional love. In the case of film projects, you park next to a subject and you say, I'm here. This is what I've chosen. Each one has its own peculiar problems to it, and each one sort of reveals your own problems to yourself. You know, your orneriness, your crankiness, your stubbornness, whatever it is that's your foible, it'll always kick up in a new and interesting way. And you always struggle. Sometimes it comes at the beginning of the project, sometimes not till the beyond the rough cut. You struggle for that moment when you say, oh yeah, this is more than the sum of its parts. It's about this. And it's always a great moment that you wait for, you pray that it will happen. But I've yet to sort of say, oof, you know, this isn't really my cup of tea.
Well, Ken Burns, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you, dear.
Ken Burns' film about Thomas Jefferson will be shown on PBS stations February 18th and 19th.